Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org. Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club and the moderator for tonight's program. It is my great pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, George Mitchell, former U.S. Senator from Maine and chairman of the worldwide law firm DLA Piper. Senator Mitchell is one of those extraordinary individuals whose career has spanned many fields of endeavor, taking on the toughest of problems and in every case accomplishing results that had previously been thought impossible. The son of a Lebanese mother and an Irish father and a native of Maine, Senator Mitchell graduated from Maine's Bowdoin College and Georgetown Law School. He began his public service career as an antitrust lawyer with the U.S. Department of Justice, later serving as executive assistant to Senator Edmund Muskie and as U.S. attorney for the state of Maine. He was a federal judge with the U.S. District Court for Maine and then was appointed to Edmund Muskie's seat in the U.S. Senate by the governor of Maine in 1980. Mr. Mitchell was elected to the Senate twice and in just two full terms became Senate Majority Leader. Six times during his tenure, he was voted the most respected member of Congress. He declined an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court from President Clinton, choosing instead to focus on passing the health care plan that was then before the Senate. This was one of many times when Senator Mitchell took the path of hard work, solving the most challenging problems, rather than perhaps an easier route to glory. Deciding not to seek re-election to the Senate in 1994, Senator Mitchell returned to the practice of law, but was soon tapped to become the U.S. Special Envoy to Northern Ireland, where in an intense 36-hour negotiation in 1995, he produced the historic Good Friday Agreement, which ended the violence in Northern Ireland. His personal work with the parties is largely credited for the success of this agreement. In 2007, at the request of Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, he led the investigation of the Balco steroids affair, releasing a courageous 400-page report, which includes the names of 89 former and current players for whom it indicates evidence of use of steroids or other prohibited substances exists. This inexhaustible man has written four books on widely varying topics: Great American Lighthouses, World on Fire, Saving an Endangered Earth, Not for America Alone, The Triumph of Democracy and the Fall of Communism, and Making Peace. He's chaired such major corporations as Walt Disney Company, Federal Express, Xerox, Staples, and the Boston Red Sox. Please join me in welcoming truly a man for all seasons and a man who has made extraordinary contributions to the public good, Senator George Mitchell.
Thank you very much, Gloria, for that generous introduction. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your warm reception. It's a pleasure for me to join you here at the Commonwealth Club. I'm going to talk tonight about challenges that we face in the 21st century, and in my remarks, I'm not going to make any reference to my time in the Senate. I don't want to leave a false impression suggesting by omission that I really didn't care for it, because I enjoyed it very much. And so before I get to the serious side of my remarks, I want to tell you a couple stories about the Senate, how I got there, what it was like. I was serving as a federal judge in my home state of Maine, as Gloria indicated in her introduction, when Senator Muskie was appointed Secretary of State. The governor of Maine announced that he would act promptly to appoint a successor because it was in the middle of a legislative session and he didn't want Maine to be underrepresented in the Senate for an extended period of time. So there was a brief but intense period of media speculation. We had a former governor, a former senator, former congressman who were mentioned. My name was not mentioned, and it didn't occur to me that I might be under consideration because I'd just become a federal judge the year before. So on the night before the governor had scheduled a press conference at the state capitol, I went to bed like everyone else in Maine, wondering what he was going to do. And then late that evening, the phone rang. It was the governor calling. He said, "I'd like you to come down to the state capitol so that I can appoint you to the Senate." And I said, "Well, gee, governor, this is a really big decision. It's a surprise. I need time to think about it. I've got to consult with my family and ponder whether I ought to leave being a federal judge after such a short period of time." He said, "Well, look," he said, "there's not much time. I'll give you 1 hour. When I protested that it was insufficient, he pointed out that he had only until noon the next day when the press conference was scheduled, and if I called him up at midnight and said no, he'd be stuck trying to get someone else, and most of the time was in the middle of the night. So he insisted that I call him back in an hour. So I agreed, and I immediately called my three older brothers. I grew up in a small town in Maine, and I had three older brothers who were very famous athletes, very well known, not just in our community, but all around the state, even in New England. And then I came along, and I was not as good an athlete as my brothers. In fact, I was not as good as anybody else's brother. So at a very early age, I began to be known around our small town as Johnny Mitchell's kid brother, the one who isn't any good. As you might expect, I developed a massive inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. So that night when I called them, ostensibly to seek their advice, I confess that there was a note of triumphalism in my voice as I informed them that the governor wanted to appoint me to the United States Senate. What did they think about that? Well, they responded immediately and predictably in a negative way. My brother Johnny began by saying, "Look, everybody knows you're a born loser." He said, "No one can understand how you got to be a federal judge. You couldn't possibly win a statewide election. And besides," he said, in what he obviously regarded as the clinching argument, "the people of Maine are entitled to have a qualified person representing them in the Senate." My two other brothers added their comments in less polite terms, but they made the same point. And so I hung up the phone angrily. I called the governor and I said, "Governor, I don't need an hour. I've already received all the reassurance I need of my ability to perform this, the duties of this office." So I went down to the state capitol the next day. The governor made the announcement and I flew down to Washington for the swearing-in, which was scheduled for the following morning, Tuesday. On the flight down, I fantasized about what it would be like. I wondered whether the Senate gallery was large enough to house the thousands that I knew would want to come and observe this historic event. I wondered whether all three networks, or maybe only two of them, would carry it live. When I landed at the airport in Washington, it was late afternoon, and instead of going directly to the hotel, I decided to take a taxi up to the Capitol to find and introduce myself to the then Senate Majority Leader. I did that, he was on the floor of the Senate where a debate was going on regarding legislation then pending. And when I made my way there and was introduced to him by a clerk, it was obvious he had only a vague idea of who I was and what I was doing there. That was somewhat disillusioning. He appeared to believe that I was there to be sworn in immediately, so he said, "Okay, we'll swear you in right now." I protested. I said, no, we got a big ceremony scheduled for tomorrow. He said, "Listen, young man, we're very busy here, and we'll swear you in right now." So he did. He interrupted the proceedings, swore me in. It took about 8 or 9 seconds at most. Even the senators standing 6 and 8 feet, 10 feet away didn't know what had gone on. And then the Senate immediately resumed the debate, and very shortly thereafter, a vote occurred. For those of you interested in political trivia, and most people are, I hold the all-time record in American history for having cast a vote the shortest time after becoming a member of Congress. 2 minutes. And that was the first of many informed judgments I made in your behalf. Well, then, as soon as the vote occurred, I had no idea what to do, and a young man came rushing at me, out of breath. He had run over from the office building and introduced himself to me as my new administrative assistant. He had been Senator Muskie's assistant, now he was mine. And he began by berating me for permitting myself to be sworn in a day ahead of schedule. I didn't say anything, and when he got done criticizing me, he took a card out of his pocket, and he read off a list of things that I was to do for the rest of the day. And he ended by saying, we got an interesting invitation here for you for this evening. And when I inquired what it was, he said that there's a convention of certified public accountants going on in Washington, 3,000 of them, and they just called. And they wanted to know if I would come down and deliver the keynote address at their convention this evening. And I said to myself, gosh, this is just amazing. I said, until yesterday, I myself didn't know I would be here. And to think that these guys would hold this important speaking opportunity open for me. Ah, no, he said, it's nothing like that. He said, they've had 4 last-minute cancellations. He said, and you're the only member of Congress they could think of who might not have anything to do tonight. And so they wondered if you'd come down and talk to them. I said, well, what do they want me to talk about? He said, the tax code. I said, well, now, wait a minute. I said, these guys are certified public accountants, 3,000 of them, and so every single member of the audience will know more about the subject than I do. I said, I can't go down and talk to them about that. And he looked at me with disgust and said, Senator, with that attitude, you'll never get anywhere in politics. He said, you're now a United States senator, and you'll regularly be called upon to address in public subjects about which you know nothing. So he said, you might as well get into practice now and start acting like a senator. So I went down, and I told the CPAs what's in the tax code. Any of you got any questions about that, I'll be glad to deal with them later. Well, then the next day, the majority leader said to me, he said, you're in luck. He said, we don't have filibusters too often, but we're having one tonight. And you can come over and see how things work around here. After I was there, I found out it's how they don't work, but that's the way it was described. So at 6 o'clock that evening, I went over to the Senate, took my seat in the chamber way back in the corner, number 100, and I looked around, and to my astonishment, I was the only senator in the entire chamber. And I thought, this is an odd way to do business. And then after a while, one senator came in, and he got up, and he said, I want to say a few words. And he spoke for 6 hours. Since I was the only other person in the chamber, he spoke to me for 6 hours. About halfway through, I began to think, I'm really not learning anything here. But I swear, I didn't move a muscle. I didn't even twitch. But he sensed it. He walked over right in front of me and began addressing himself to me, pointing his finger in my face as he spoke. The gestures bore no relationship to the words, but I thought, well, it must look good on TV. So I didn't budge, and he talked to me. And then after about 6 hours, he called for a vote on a procedural matter. I don't know if any of you have ever been in the nation's capital. When a vote occurs, you know that loud bells ring, lights flash. That tells the senators and members of the House that a vote's occurring, and they've got so much time to go to the chamber and cast their vote. So the lights flashed, the bells rang, and into the same chamber poured the other 98 senators. They all cast their votes, and then they all left, including the guy who just talked to me for 6 hours. And for a moment, I didn't realize what was going on. I didn't know what to do. Well, before I realized it, another guy came in, and he talked to me for 6 more hours. And this went on all night long. And so by the next morning, I was very tired. I was hungry. I went to a clerk standing by the side of the Senate door, by the door by the chamber there, and I said, listen, I said, excuse me, I'm new here. He said, Senator, that's obvious to everyone. He said, "What do you want?" I said, "Well," I said, "I'm out here tending the nation's business, and I'm the only one out here. Where do these other senators go? What do they do?" And he said, I'll do better than tell you. I'll show you." So he took me around right in back of the speaker's chair there in the Senate chamber to a room not much bigger than this where there are a whole bunch of narrow canvas folding cots set up of the type you see in emergency shelters. And there, lying there in their clothes, snoring away, were the members of the U.S. Senate. My second disillusioning moment in less than a day. It was very crowded, and there were no aisles, so he said to me, "Senator, there's an empty cot there. You better grab it." I had to climb over other senators to get there, and that made me very nervous. The first senator I had to climb over was Ted Kennedy. Now, Ted's a great friend, but he's not a slight fellow, as you know. And at that moment, he looked to me like Mount Everest. So I had to use all the athletic skill that my brothers insist I don't have. I climbed over him, and before I could heave a sigh of relief on the other side, I looked, and on the next cot lying there on his back, snoring away, was Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina. Now, I'd only been there a day, but I was aware of Senator Helms' reputation as a staunch defender of heterosexual rights. So I was really nervous climbing over there, and I said, "My God, what if I lose my balance and fall right on top of him here in the nation's capital with 98 unimpeachable witnesses?" So I did. I got over, and I realized once I got onto this empty cot and laid there that I had made the biggest mistake of my life. Just a day earlier, I'd been a dignified person, a federal judge. I even wore a black robe to convey a sense of dignity. Now, here I was lying there with a bunch of old guys just snoring away, and I thought, "God, what a mistake I've made." And I wallowed in self-pity, and as I was really at a moment of intense self-pity, I rolled over on this cot, and I looked right next to me, just a few inches away, into the face of Senator John Warner of Virginia. Now, at that time, Senator Warner was married to Elizabeth Taylor. So I looked at him, and I thought, "Who am I to feel sorry for myself?" I thought, here's a guy who could be home in bed with his wife, and he's spending the night with me. And I realized what we all know, but we tend to forget, and that is no matter how bad off you've got it, there's always someone who's got it worse. And you can go through life complaining, whining, and feeling sorry for yourself, or you can try to do something about the problems that you see around you. And that's what I did in the Senate, which I enjoyed very much. They're all interesting, good people trying to do their best for the country as they see it. And I very much enjoyed my time and the associations I made there. But now I want to get to the serious subject that I was asked to discuss, and that is our country's role in the world, and in particular the challenges that we will face in the coming decades. In the 20th century, democracy faced three threats to its existence: depression, fascism, and communism. The signal event of that century was the ultimate triumph of democracy. In the aftermath of the Second World War, in an effort to secure the peace and to promote stability and prosperity, the United States led the way in the creation of new international institutions and arrangements. The United Nations was created, NATO was established, on the continent the European Union was founded, Germany and Japan were rebuilt, became democratic, and resurgent. All this and more helped what started as the North Atlantic Alliance, a relationship between the United States and Britain, become the most successful economic, political, and military collaboration in modern history. But that alliance is now under great stress, just as its members and others around the world face new threats in the potential convergence of several very dangerous trends. The first and perhaps most dangerous is the possible proliferation of nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. The United States led the world into the nuclear age, and we led the effort to restrain the proliferation of these fearsome weapons. As a result, many countries with the capacity to develop nuclear weapons have refrained from doing so voluntarily because they trusted the leadership of the United States. In the last few years, that trust has been shaken, and the entire non-proliferation regime is at risk. There are now 9 countries with nuclear weapons, and Iran is trying hard to make it 10. Within a decade, we could face a nightmare scenario under which the nuclear non-proliferation regime collapses, the number of nations with nuclear weapons increases sharply, and terrorist groups gain access to nuclear materials. That leads to a second dangerous trend, which is the increase in the number of terrorist groups and their decentralization. Intelligence agencies and experts tell us that there are now many more such groups. They tend to be smaller and less centrally controlled, making detection, infiltration, and prevention much more difficult than it was just a few years ago. A third trend is the rise of Islamic fundamentalism. It has, of course, recurred regularly in the 13 centuries of Islam's existence, as has internal division and conflict. The dispute now is exacerbated by rapid population growth in the Muslim world, stagnant economies, the absence of opportunity for large parts of the population, the presence of so many non-democratic regimes, and deep and widespread feelings of alienation and humiliation. What the Islamic countries need, of course, is what everyone needs: the modernization of their economies, the widespread acquisition of knowledge and technological skill, economic growth, job creation, and to help all of that happen, the strengthening of moderates. A fourth trend is the increasing competition for energy security among the developed and the developing nations. Driven by growth in China and India, in 2006, oil consumption in Asia exceeded that in North America for the first time. With rising demand in those two very populous countries, with political instability in the important producing areas, especially the Middle East, continuing, there's likely to be a more intense competition for stable sources of supply well into the foreseeable future. A fifth and related trend of concern is climate change. Although there still are some doubters, the clear weight of scientific evidence is that the Earth is warming and that man-made emissions are a principal cause. The consequences of our failure to act could be disastrous for future generations. We don't lack knowledge. What is lacking, particularly here in the United States and in China and India, is the political will needed to do what we all know must be done. There is, of course, no single act or policy or decision which will enable us to reverse these trends. But some needs are clear. First, we must be realistic about the threats we face. They're real and dangerous, and we must treat them as such. But they're also very different from the threats we faced in the 20th century, and we must recognize and act upon those differences. First, it's unlikely that we will, at any time in the near future, face a major conflict involving nation states. More likely will be a continuing series of actions by non-government organizations committed to the use of terror, many of them covertly supported by other governments. So one need is for a much more effective counterterror program. If we've learned anything in the past few years, it is that military force by itself is plainly insufficient because counterterrorism is not a conventional war. As has been made clear in Iraq, in the south of Lebanon 2 years ago, in the north of Lebanon, in the north of Ireland a few years before that. Overwhelming military superiority does not guarantee victory because these conflicts are not conventional wars. So our efforts must include more effective and cooperative police work, more aggressive diplomacy, economic and financial interdiction, and much more that is not primarily military in nature. It's constantly referred to as the war on terror, but terror is a tactic, not an enemy. While the use of terror is widespread, there are many differences among those who use that tactic. Some have specific political objectives. Some do not. Some are coherent political groups with whom dialogue is possible. Some are not. And some, like Al-Qaeda, shouldn't be talked to and should be simply the objects of destruction. So it's inaccurate, it's unhelpful, and ultimately it's self-deluding and dangerous to ourselves to simply lump everyone together in one simple category. A more effective counterterror program must include the common sense needed to discern the differences among the many users of terror in the world. As a high priority, the network of alliances among free nations that developed over the past half century under the leadership of the United States and the United Kingdom must be renewed and reinvigorated. And this leads me to a final dangerous and disturbing trend, and that's the rising tide of hostility to the United States throughout the world. Today, American power is ascendant in the world, yet Americans aren't celebrating, nor is anyone else. To the contrary, poll after poll after poll reports widespread hostility to the United States throughout the world. Our power is the greatest it's ever been, but our standing in the world is the lowest it's ever been. Never in the 220 years of our nation's history has our country been held in such low esteem in so many places. That ought to be a matter of concern to every American. There isn't much doubt about this result, although there is doubt and debate about the causes. There are many reasons, among them the reality that every dominant power in history has aroused antagonism simply by virtue of its dominance. And some of the policies of the current administration have exacerbated that antagonism. But whatever the cause, it's imperative that we reverse this negative attitude because it severely impairs our ability to create the effective coalitions needed to deal with the many problems we face. This is much more than a theoretical or just a moral problem. It is a practical problem. It affects our national security every day in many ways. We now see that effect in Iraq, in our dealings with Iran and North Korea, in the effort to resolve the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and elsewhere. So it's critical to our national interest that we rebuild our historic relationships and that we regain our moral stature in the world. In the past several years, beginning as Senate Majority Leader and continuing since, I've met and talked with leaders of most of the countries in Europe, from Ireland to Russia, from Scandinavia to the Mediterranean. I asked each of them this question. Now that the Soviet Union no longer exists and Russia has withdrawn its military forces back to its national territory, do you believe that the United States should withdraw its military forces back to its national territory? Without exception, everyone responded with an immediate and emphatic no. Ask yourself, why do some countries, or at least their leaders, want American military forces on their soil or in their continent? And how can that be reconciled with the widespread hostility to the United States to which I earlier referred? Well, part of the answer lies in power itself. Most people want to be on the side of the strong. But for too many people, in and out of our country, American power and American principles appear to be diverging. Power, economic and military power, increasingly is perceived to be the primary, or to some even the exclusive basis of American influence in the world. But I believe that perception is wrong. We should never forget that the United States was a great nation long before it was a great military or economic power. This was a great nation from the moment of birth because of the ideals upon which our nation was founded. Those ideals set forth in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution have, in fact, been and remain the primary basis of American influence in the world. They're not easily summarized, but surely they include the sovereignty of the people, the primacy of individual liberty, opportunity for every member of society, and the rule of law applied equally to all citizens and to the government itself. We have power to protect us and principles to guide us. One without the other will be inadequate to meet the challenges of this century. We must be prepared to use our power, including military force, when necessary and appropriate. But when our power is deployed, it should be in a manner consistent with our ideals. There's another point that I think is so important that I must mention it here. I recall clearly my first day in Northern Ireland 13 years ago. I saw for the first time the huge wall that physically separates the communities in Belfast, the capital and largest city of Northern Ireland. 30 feet high, topped in places with barbed wire, it remains an ugly reminder of the intensity and duration of that conflict. Ironically, it's called the Peace Line. On that first morning, I met with Catholics on their side of the wall, in the afternoon with Protestants on their side. Their messages had not been coordinated, but they were much the same. In Belfast, they told me there was a high correlation between unemployment and violence. A Protestant minister, one of the most powerful and persuasive orators I've ever heard, brought two maps, one a map of unemployment in the urban areas of Northern Ireland, the other a map showing violence in the urban areas of Northern Ireland, and they fit like a glove. Their messages weren't coordinated, but both sides said the same thing. And they told me that men and women had no opportunity, had no hope, they were much more likely to take the path of violence. They told me that despair is the fuel for instability and that hope is essential to peace and stability. Men and women everywhere need income to support their families and themselves, and they need the satisfaction of doing something worthwhile and meaningful in their lives. The conflict in Northern Ireland obviously has not been exclusively or even primarily economic. It involves religion, national identity, territorial disputes, and other factors. But if there is to be durable peace there and elsewhere, people need hope. There can be no hope without opportunity, and that requires economic growth and job creation. And economic growth cannot be just a product of democracy. It's essential for the success of democracy. To a man without a job, to a woman who can't feed or care for her children, to a young adult lacking in education or skill, debates about democracy seem abstract, even irrelevant. They worry about coping, about surviving day to day. Democracy means the rule of the people. That is the literal meaning of the word. It's drawn from two Greek words, demos, the people, kratzi, the rule of. It also must mean opportunity for all of the people. The 21st century can be, like many in the past, a time of endless war, of famine, of oppression, of injustice. But it also could be a time when the dominant power uses its strength carefully and wisely and commits its people, its power, and its prestige to a great and noble vision, a world largely at peace, with freedom, education, opportunity, and prosperity extending to more and more people around the world. That's our challenge. We must make it our destiny. I want to close with just a personal story about the meaning of this country to me. As I said earlier, before I entered the Senate, I served as a federal judge. In that position, I had great power. In fact, it's the only job I've ever had in which I had any power. The majority leader of the Senate has only the opportunity to ask other senators to do things that they should do without being asked. And when I chaired the various peace talks that I was involved in, I couldn't compel anybody to do anything. But when I was a federal judge, I could and did regularly order people to do things. And I'll tell you, without exception, they did what I ordered. And I loved that part of the job. But what I most enjoyed was when I presided over what are called naturalization ceremonies. They're citizenship ceremonies. A group of people who'd come from every part of the world gathered before me in a federal courtroom in Maine, and there I administered to them the oath of allegiance to the United States. And by the power vested in me under our Constitution and law, I made them Americans. It was always a highly emotional ceremony for me because my mother was an immigrant, my father the orphan son of immigrants. Neither of my parents had any education. My mother couldn't read or write. My father left school after the fourth grade. She worked nights in textile mills. He was a janitor at a local college. But because of their efforts, and more importantly, because of the openness of American society, I, their son, was able to get the education they never had and became the majority leader of the United States Senate. After each of these ceremonies, I made it a point to speak personally with every one of the new Americans, individually or in family groups. I asked them where they came from, why they came, how they came. Their stories were different, all inspiring. Most of us in this room tonight are Americans by an accident of birth. Each of them is an American by an act of free will, often at great cost and risk to themselves and their families. But there were some common themes, and they were best summarized by a young Asian man who, when I asked him why he came, replied in very slow and halting English. "I came," he said, "because in America, everybody has a chance." Think about the fact that a young man who had been an American for 10 minutes, who could barely speak English, was able to sum up the meaning of our country in a single sentence. America is freedom and opportunity. And our task is to conduct ourselves in a way that 100 years from now, people all around the world will still want to come to America because they will believe, and it will be true, that here in America, everybody does have a chance. Thank you all very much for having me, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you. Yeah.
Our thanks to Senator Mitchell for his comments this evening, and of course we have many questions, so let's get started with those. Since you started off in a humorous vein, Senator Mitchell, I'm going to start the first question in a similarly humorous vein.
All right.
Who was more difficult to work with, Republicans in the Senate, the IRA, Commissioner Bud Selig, or the Major League Baseball Players Association, and how about Tony Blair?
In retrospect, they were really all pretty good to work with. I have to make one correction. I never worked directly with the IRA. In Northern Ireland, the political structure was that there were political parties that were affiliated with paramilitary organizations. Although they denied affiliations, I think they were widely accepted to exist. But there was never any dealing between myself and the colleagues who accompanied me and the paramilitary organizations. Our dealings were with the political parties with whom they were affiliated. But the truth is that in the Senate, Just for example, Bob Dole was a minority leader for the 6 years that I served as Senate Majority Leader. We disagreed on many issues almost every day, but to this moment, there has never been a harsh personal word between us, in public or in private. I count Bob Dole as one of my good friends. I think he regards me the same way, and we were able to conduct business in a way in which we disagreed on the issues, but we didn't make it personal. And I hope that there would be more of that in our system today.
A bit more seriously,
There
are many questions about the Northern Ireland peace process. How did you succeed in bringing peace in Northern Ireland when so much time had passed with so much bitterness? What was the key element in your resolving the Ireland problem? Could you just tell us a little bit how you did that?
I think a definitive answer will await the passage of time and the judgment of history. I have some views. They are necessarily speculative. Sometimes when you're in the eye of the hurricane, you're not in the best position to make long-term judgments. But first, I think there was an exhaustion with conflict by the people. They are sick of the war. They were unable to lead normal lives. Fear and anxiety hung over that society like a heavy, unyielding fog. It was just very difficult, and I think people just got sick and tired of it. Secondly, the emergence and entry of women into the political and the peace process to a degree that had not previously existed, much of which was based upon the losses, the grievous losses of husbands and sons and brothers that they had suffered, and a desire for peace. A third factor was the courage and perseverance of the governments of Britain and Ireland. Not much credit has been given to him, but they deserve it. Tony Blair was mentioned in the earlier question. Tony Blair and the Irish Prime Minister, Bertie Ahern, were courageous, superb political leaders in democratic societies. When we got to the end, down to the wire, I called the two of them, asked them to come to Belfast. If they had checked with a political consultant, they would have been told not to come because there was little chance of success. Just 4 days earlier, a public opinion poll had been published in Northern Ireland which reported that 83% of the public believed no agreement was possible. 7% thought it was possible. 10% had no opinion. But they came. And they didn't just come and sit there. They came and conducted the negotiations personally, day and night, without sleep, in a way that brought it to a conclusion. So superb leadership by the two governments and by the political leaders of Northern Ireland. Like politicians here, they're maligned, they're criticized, they're ridiculed. A lot of it's well-earned and deserved. But these are men and women who had lived through conflict, who themselves were vulnerable personally, physically, in their families. And yet they rose to the occasion under the most extraordinarily difficult and dangerous circumstances to reach an agreement at a time when there were factions on both sides who regarded any compromise as a surrender and a lack of conviction. And so the political leaders of Northern Ireland deserve really most of the credit, and the other reasons that I've suggested I think are relevant as well.
You mentioned the rise of hostility in the world to the U.S. What do you think the impact of the current financial crisis is on U.S. influence in the world?
I think it is producing a decline in U.S. influence in the world, although it does, in a curious and somewhat paradoxical way, demonstrate how interrelated the world is, how we are interconnected, and how just as the problem originated here, the solution must originate here. Despite all of the many challenges that we face, I am, in fact, highly optimistic about our ability as a nation to deal with these problems, to emerge from them stronger and better as a nation, as we have emerged from every prior crisis in our history, and to reassert a leadership role around the world. I do not believe that these widespread expressions of hostility to the United States are irreversible. I believe, to the contrary, that there is a widespread yearning for constructive American leadership, for the kind of leadership that takes into account the views of others but reserves the ultimate right to act in behalf of its people to itself, an appropriate stance, but a leadership that is, in fact, willing to engage. And I think that not only is that possible, I think that will happen, and I think we can restore our standing in the world. And I'll make one other point. I mentioned this in my remarks. I want to amplify it. I referred to the rule of law, and I said the rule of law applies equally to everyone, including the government. And I want to emphasize that point. When the government breaks the law, it sets an example for every member of society. And we have had actions in the past 8 years that have been contrary to the principles of our Constitution and contrary to the rights of individual citizens. And that has sent a signal around the world. I have to tell you, I do travel around the world. You very rarely hear talk about this in the United States, but you hear it often outside the United States. President Bush has claimed since 9/11 and to this moment claims that he has the legal authority to cause the arrest of any person in this country, to hold that person in prison indefinitely without charge, without trial, and that his decision cannot be questioned or challenged by any court. That is fundamentally contrary to the democratic principles set forth in the American Constitution. And that sends a message around the world. So one of the things we must do is to reaffirm that we are a nation of laws, not of men. We do not shrink from the war on terror. We are prepared with vigor, with energy, and with force where necessary to protect our people. But we can do it without undermining the fundamental principles of the American Constitution.
So just developing this issue about concerns about the Constitution, what else is on your list? Habeas corpus, posse comitatus, freedom of speech, executive exceptions. What's on your list of concerns about the U.S. Constitution at this point?
Well, each one of those...
And what should be done about the...
Well, each one of those is a 40-minute speech and a 30-page law journal
article.
But how
extensive do you think the... Yeah. The encroachment on the Constitution is at this point?
I personally believe that the issue that I raised is the one that is paramount. This is a crude analogy, but I think it applies. If you picture a football field, they're engaged between the goal lines. A lot of this discussion, I think, is within the goal lines. I don't agree with a lot in the Patriot Act, but some of it makes sense. That's within the goal lines. You can argue about it. You can say this shouldn't be, that shouldn't be. But one person, the President of the United States, claiming the authority to arrest and hold without charge, without trial, any person in this country, and that his decisions can't be reviewed by any court, to me, is not only outside the goal lines, it's outside the end zone, it's outside the stadium. And rather than getting into a laundry list of all the others, I'd like to see that changed.
Going back to your list of threats, dangers in the current world, yeah. This question asks, assuming that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is one of the sources of Islamic fundamentalist disdain for the U.S., what should the next administration's approach be to this conflict?
After I left Northern Ireland, President Clinton, then Prime Minister Barak, and Chairman Arafat asked me to go to the Middle East as chairman of an international fact-finding commission to make recommendations on how to end the violence that erupted late in the year 2000. We did so. We presented a report with recommendations to President Bush, who had been elected shortly after we were appointed, both the Israelis and the Palestinians said that they accepted our report with some reservations. Unfortunately, it wasn't pursued vigorously, and the conflict continues to this day. Our report was largely incorporated into the so-called roadmap, which is now the U.S. policy, supported by what is called the quartet, U.S., European Union, the U.N., and Russia. I believe that the next president, either Senator McCain or Senator Obama, should and will initiate a new effort in the region, because I believe it is possible to resolve the conflict and to bring it to a just resolution. I do so in part because of the conviction I formed in Northern Ireland that there is no such thing as a conflict that can't be ended. They're created, they're conducted, they're sustained by human beings, they can be ended by human beings. Now, the problem in the Middle East is very, very complex and difficult, and it cannot be viewed in isolation from the rest of the region. You can't just say, I'm going to go talk to the Israelis and Palestinians, I'm going to ignore the Syrians, the Iranians, the Egyptians, the Saudis, everybody else. It's a regional issue with many internal conflicts, the Shia-Sunni conflict, for example, being very well known, and many others, that have to be taken into account. But in the end, I believe it's resolvable for a simple, fundamental reason, that it is in the interests of both sides to see that it's resolved. Although their circumstances and objectives are different, they do offer an opportunity to bring it to a close. The Israeli circumstance is that they have a state. What they want is security for their people, an appropriate and legitimate concern. They live in unbearable fear and anxiety of suicide bombings and unrestrained rocket attacks. The Palestinians, on the other hand, don't have a state, and they want one. A geographically contiguous, economically viable state in which they can have the right to determine their own futures. I believe that neither can attain its objective by denying to the other side its objective. Stated another way, I don't think the Palestinians are ever going to get a state through suicide bombing and unrestrained rocketing. Until the people of Israel have a reasonable and sustainable sense of security, no Israeli government is going to permit the creation of a Palestinian state. On the other hand, I believe that the Israelis cannot secure sustainable peace, sustainable security over the long term until the Palestinian aspiration for a state is resolved. So I think the only way they can get what they want is to see that the other side gets what they want. And I believe that's possible, and it is striking that to this day, despite all of the horrific events of the past few years and before, still majorities in both societies favor the two-state solution and the political process needed to bring it about. What is lacking is any semblance of trust. There is a total mistrust on both sides in the intentions, in the aspirations, in the words of the other. And so it is only the United States government, only the United States government. There is no entity on earth, public or private, that has the capacity to create the context in which negotiations can take place to reach an agreement and to see that it's implemented. I emphasize that last word, implemented. It was very, very hard to get a peace agreement in Northern Ireland. It was much more difficult to gain implementation of that agreement. That will be the case in the Middle East. It is obviously proving difficult to get an agreement. After years of effort, there isn't one. But I assure you, an agreement will by itself not solve the issue. Agreements are not self-executing. They require painstaking and persevering effort to gain implementation, to get people to do what they say they're going to do. And I think only the U.S. government can do it. And I'm very hopeful. Indeed, I would say somewhat confident that both Senator McCain and Senator Obama understand that and will initiate a new effort. One of the great tragedies of Iraq is not just what has happened in Iraq, but it is that we have taken our eye off the central issues, both in Afghanistan and Pakistan and in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And I hope that there'll be a refocus of American interest, effort, and the application of resources in the region.
Coming back home to the U.S. for a moment, virtually every member of Congress that one sees these days, House and Senate members, complain about partisan squabbling and point their finger at what's not getting done because of the polarization within the House and Senate. Congressman Joe Sestak was here just last week talking about this in San Francisco. You and three other former majority leaders created the Bipartisan Policy Center, and this questioner says it carries a wonderful message with very important content. To what extent do you think bipartisanship will gain momentum next year, and to what degree does it depend on which candidate wins the presidency?
I think it will be difficult, whoever is elected, because it is a very difficult circumstance. First, I think we should shed the rose-colored glasses when we look to the past. We have a tendency to view the past in a way that filters out anything that was bad and makes it seem like a wonderful time when there were no problems. Rough politics is not new in the United States. There have been a couple of books written recently about the election of 1800, the battle between Jefferson and John Adams. Anybody who has the view, who has the rose-colored view, go back and read about that election. Read about the election of 1864 when Abraham Lincoln was running for re-election. Read about the election of 1932 and 36 when Franklin Roosevelt was running for re-election. They've always been tough. There are a number of factors which, in my mind, have exacerbated partisanship recently. First is the immense power of electronic communication, especially television, which enables and enhances the 30-second negative attack ad. Second is flowing from that is the immense amount of money which is required, which tends to corrupt the relationship between the people and the elected officials. Third is the enormous power of repetition that comes from this competitive cable network business where every misstatement is repeated hundreds, thousands of times, which creates an indelible impression of error, even when the report may itself be wrong. It's very hard for the truth to catch up to false impressions in that way. But in the end, these tactics are used because they work. And when the American people decide they've had enough of them, and when they vote against people who use these tactics, and candidates see that they don't work anymore, then they'll stop.
Partisanship back in the Clinton-Gingrich days had a role in derailing national health care legislation. Do you think that was an opportunity missed that will never come again? Do you think we're going to see another serious effort for health care reform in the United States?
Yes, I do. In fact, the bipartisan group that you mentioned, Senators Daschle, Dole, Baker, and myself, are now involved in an effort to reach agreement on a consensus series of bipartisan health care proposals that we will present to the next president and the next Congress for their consideration. And I think it will happen simply because it's necessary. It's necessary both for the health of the people of our country, it's necessary for the health of our government. It's the single biggest problem in terms of government financing. People say Social Security is a big problem. Well, it is a real problem, but it is not so much in the retirement and disability portions, it's in the Medicare portion. It is the rising cost of health care in our country. And sadly, the results that don't correspond with the amount spent that confronts our society and our government with serious problems. We'll spend over $2 trillion this year, 16% of our gross domestic product, and the absolute amount is likely to double in the next several years. And we don't have the best outcomes. And the amount of wasted money is simply incredible. Been documented many times. One report is that about 30% of all surgical procedures performed in the United States are either unnecessary or don't achieve any beneficial result. And we don't have anywhere near the degree of emphasis on prevention and wellness that we should as a society. And that impacts on a lot more than the adults in this room. It's most pronounced in the area of young people. When I was involved in the healthcare effort in 1994, I visited healthcare facilities around the country. And I will never forget a visit I made to the Tampa General Hospital in Tampa, Florida, a large, diverse community. As I was walking through the pediatric ward, the chief pediatrician, a woman doctor, said to me, Senator, would you come over here? We want you to see our million-dollar babies. And along the wall were a row of incubators with infants in them, each of whom had been born prematurely. And with respect to each of them, the cost of keeping them alive had passed $1 million. This is 15 years ago, so it's real money then and even more money now. And they had, knowing I was coming, they had invited some of the mothers to come in. And I talked to them. They were different, mostly poor, mostly minority, but the most striking thing of all is that of the small group of mothers I talked with, not one had seen a physician between the moment of conception and the moment of birth. I then had a daughter of childbearing age, and it struck me like a thunderbolt. It was unthinkable to me that if my wife or my daughter became pregnant, that she wouldn't see a doctor. And I'll bet it's unthinkable for almost every person in this room. And yet, what is unthinkable to us is the reality of life for thousands and thousands and thousands of our fellow Americans. There is not a woman in this country, I don't care where she's from or what her circumstances, that should not be able to see a doctor between conception and birth. It isn't just that it would be better for the woman. It isn't just that it would be better for the infant. Think of the cost savings to us if we could just reduce the number of million-dollar babies. And the examples I could go on, I could spend the whole rest of the evening on this, that people who don't have insurance getting their primary care in emergency rooms where care costs four times as much as if they got it through a primary care physician. So we have to do something, and our objective is to try to achieve the three important goals that are interrelated. Everybody should be covered, but please understand, universal coverage by itself will not solve the problem. We have to maintain a high level of quality, and we have to control the cost. Now, every society in the world now struggles with these problems. And you deal with one, and the other one pops up. And then you deal with that, and another one pops up. And we've got to figure out a better way as a society and a country to achieve those objectives. I believe it can be done. It's why I turned down an offer to go on the Supreme Court, because I felt it was necessary in 1994. And I feel it's even more necessary today, because we've had another 14 years of experience with a system that is obviously not working as it should. And the striking thing is how everybody in the system feels it's not working, from doctors to patients, from hospitals and everybody else. And we just have to do better, and I believe that we can, and I think it's incumbent on anybody who can do something about it to try to do so, and that's what the other senators and I are trying to do.
It's time for a last question, unfortunately. I'd love to have this discussion with you for many hours. You talked about the U.S. moral stature as being the main way that we have influence in the world. In thinking about how to restore the U.S. moral stature, we have a new president, January 20th. What are the first few things he could do that would help to restore U.S. moral influence?
Well, the first thing I would hope that he would instruct the Department of Justice to withdraw from the position that this administration has taken in the Supreme Court on the issue of the president's authority that I discussed earlier. To simply say that I don't claim that authority. It's fundamentally at odds with a democracy. Secondly, not controversial because both Senator McCain and Senator Obama favor it, I'd close Guantanamo. Third, I'd say that not only do we expect the people of this country to observe the law, we expect the government to observe the law. Now, sure, it's symbolic, but it's important. Fourth, I think we have to convey to people around the world that it is principles and ideals in which we believe and to which we will attempt as best as we humanly can to conform our actions. The argument is made in favor of all of these activities that we have to protect our people, and we do. I want there to be no mistake or misimpression about that. But it's a question of how, when, and under what circumstances. Let's take the very much discussed right of preemptive action. I believe we have the right of preemptive action, as individuals and as a society. If you're walking out on a street and a fellow comes up and threatens you with a knife, you don't have to wait until the knife punctures your skin before you can do something to try to disable him or to protect yourself. And so it is with countries. The United States cannot and will not, and no president ever should, abandon the right to act unilaterally when there is an imminent danger threatening our people. The tough issue is, when is it imminent? Now, what we all now know is that it was not imminent in the case of Iraq. There was no imminent threat to the United States or to the United Kingdom. And the arguments presented by the President of the United States and the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom turned out to be false. So there really isn't much disagreement on the principles. It's how you apply the principles and in what circumstances and what judgments you make. And that's why judgment matters so much in terms of who we're electing. And I just don't accept the notion that the only way you can combat terrorism is to not observe the demands of the Constitution and not honor the rights of Americans. I think you can do both. It is a false dichotomy, just like the old one we used to face. If you were protecting the environment, you must be against jobs. Or if you were for jobs or economic growth, you somehow were against the environment. We've now all figured out that's a completely false dichotomy. In fact, the opposite may be true. With the green technology coming up, there may be a huge business opportunity for us and for people around the world. Well, the same thing is true in this area, I believe. And I think that we can and must remain vigilant, strong. I repeat, we must be prepared to use force when necessary and appropriate. But we can make it clear that we believe in the Constitution, we believe in the rights of our citizens, we believe in the rule of law applying to the government, and we believe in genuine consultation. I've got young kids. My 11-year-old son knows when I'm really listening to him and when I'm not. And other countries know that we have not been really listening to them over the past few years. That's the difference. Genuine consultation, as opposed to going through the motions of pretending to consult and do it on your own or when you want. And we don't surrender a single inch or ounce of sovereignty in doing that. And being the kind of country that we were for a half century or more following the Second World War. Thank you all very much. A real pleasure to be here with you.
Our thanks to former U.S. Senator George Mitchell for your wonderful stories, your profound ideas, and for your tireless work on behalf of us all. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the internet. I'm Gloria Duffy, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, sponsoring public discourse for 105 years, is adjourned.